The World Health Organization estimates 350 million people globally suffer from depression. The number is growing. By 2030, it will be the number one global disease burden. It will surpass heart disease and cancer. But the stigma and discrimination associated with mental illness means that less than half of those afflicted receive treatment for depression. But there's hope. Stay tuned. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello, I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Depression affects different people in different ways. How do you know if you or someone close to you is affected? What's the cause? And how long will it last? Here's Joseph's story of what life was like before he learned what was causing his depression.
I came from a very conservative family. I was one of seven children, obviously a mother and a father, so a total of nine. It was a very loud and a happy home, and a very disciplined home. And my father, he was a man who didn't talk bad about people. He never cussed, and he didn't drink. Later in my high school life, and then after I went off to college, I went off to college at a very young age, younger than most, and I was not properly prepared in a mature standpoint. And in order to cover up that insecurity, I began to drink and do other things. I never did in the drugs or anything, but I did a lot of drinking, and my insecurities grew because I knew I was doing the things that I shouldn't be doing and I was not raised to do. But because of my insecurities, I wanted to make friends. I wanted people to like me. I wanted to be the life of the party. And so I did those things to become that. And of course, anytime you do something that you know is wrong and you continue to do what you know is wrong, it kind of eats at your soul. And I began to dislike who I was. And as a result of that, I became more angry about things and distrusting of things. But yet I continued to conduct because I thought, I don't know why, I just did.
And as a depressant, alcohol contributes to the problem of depression, while guilt also tends to worsen symptoms. Now we're off to our Loma Linda studio to interview Dr. Neil Nedley, internal medicine physician with a major interest in depression. Dr. Nedley, depression is increasing. How many of us are going to get depression during our lifetime?
Well, it's about one out of four lifetime risk, and that's kind of conservative now because every successive generation is having almost a doubling effect in the rate of depression.
Wow.
So it's a major problem, and that's called sometimes endogenous depression, where it seems to come from within. So the Surgeon General has labeled as an epidemic in our country, and really almost needs to be treated with that much care to reverse it and to prevent it from happening again.
That's amazing, because we hear about the obesity epidemic, the diabetes epidemic. People don't really talk about the depression epidemic, do they?
No, they don't, not unless maybe a suicide happens and then it's too late. Unless a mass murder happens and then people start focusing on the mental health. But other than that, it doesn't get the attention it deserves. Billions of dollars of antidepressants are being sold in this country every year.
Yeah.
It's a major problem. And if you work in a pharmacy, you know that a large section of your community is suffering from this.
Yes, that's right. So what exactly is depression?
Well, depression actually is a constellation of symptoms. You have to have five of nine symptoms to have the psychiatric definition of depression. And those symptoms are a deep sadness or emptiness. Either one would qualify. Apathy, that's when you wake up in the morning and you're not really excited about the day or interested in the day. And it can get so bad that things that used to be pleasurable for you are no longer pleasurable. That's apathy. Third symptom is more irritable or a slowing down of your muscle movement. So if you're either agitated or you have slowed, either one counts as symptom number three. Number four is sleep disturbances. Either way, either you're wanting to sleep all the time, or you're not able to sleep, or you're waking up too early and can't go back to sleep. That's the most common sleep disturbance for those with depression. Number five are weight or appetite changes. Most common is weight gain, because people have a tendency to self-medicate with soda pops and with sugary foods and chocolate, et cetera.
Right, to give that brain a bit of a kick.
Exactly, yeah, which ends up actually giving it less of a kick in the long run. And then sometimes it's anorexia or weight loss if it's sudden and severe depression. And so malnutrition, of course, can be part of this syndrome as well. And then six, lack of concentration. This is where you just don't have the focus. And it can get so bad that even reading the newspaper, you're losing focus.
Wow.
Or even watching an educational television program, you have trouble tracking after a while. That's how bad it can get. Seventh is feelings of worthlessness. That's when the depression is getting more severe, when you actually start feeling that you're worthless or that you're a major failure. And then number eight is morbid thoughts. Not just thinking about your own death, or maybe contemplating how much better it might be if you were dead. Of that, of course, would be a very severe problem if you have depression and one that needs attention.
Absolutely.
But just preoccupation with death, or symbols of death. If you're resonating with bathing suit lines that have skeletons on it, you know, that's clear that you've got morbid thoughts. That's not a natural you know, the desire per se. You have to have morbid thoughts for that. And then the ninth symptom would be that of fatigue. This is where you just don't have the energy that you used to have. Different than the apathy part, where you don't have the interest. But fatigue is you're just running out of energy too early, or you don't have the energy even early in the day. So you don't have to have all of those symptoms. Just five of nine, and that is major depression. And if you have just two of those symptoms, that's minor depression. Between two and four is minor depression, and so it's only a variant of normal if you have just one of those nine symptoms.
Wow.
So that means if you're in there two or more, you really need to pay attention to the Hope Channel and learn more about this.
Yes, so we're going to be covering a lot of information to hopefully help people that have depression, because depression is so common.
Yes.
Now, you've categorized all the causes. You've done a lot of research looking at the causes of depression, and then tried to synthesize them down to just a few. What was that process like?
Well, I should tell you that I began to get depressed myself after I'd been researching causes and found cause number 71, and I still hadn't finished yet. I didn't know where it was going to end. And I'm recognizing, wow, there are so many different causes of depression, which, by the way, are not looked for much in the medical community. We tend to diagnose it and treat it with medicine without actually searching for the underlying cause. So often the doctor or the patient, neither one of them knows the cause.
Why is it so important to know the cause? Because as you point out, someone has depression, you just write the prescription for an antidepressant. So why does knowing the cause make a difference?
Well, because if we can, most of the causes are reversible. And if we can reverse the cause, then the disease will actually be cured without medicine and without the side effects. And the other advantage is medications only do so much. A lot of trials are showing them only slightly better than placebo. And so they have their limitations. But when we get rid of the underlying cause, it's far better than medication. And so that's why anyone with depression really needs to try to find out what the underlying causes are in them, so that they might be able to get cured from this.
That's amazing. So you take a very different approach of finding the cause. That doesn't mean someone cannot have the medication to bridge them, right?
Correct.
Until they discover what the cause is and put some...
As a physician, I use antidepressants in depressed patients as well. But I recognize their limitations, and I'm looking at the bigger picture and the things that we can actually do that will help them better than those medicines in the long run.
And what are the side effects to the medications?
Well, sexual side effects are some of the big ones.
Right.
And of course, depression adversely affects sexual relations anyways. It decreases your hormone levels, both female and male hormone levels. It also decreases your social affiliation. And then when you add on to it sexual side effects, that's a big one.
Right, because your relationship is so strained anyway, and then
exactly.
you throw that into the
that's
mix,
right.
and
yeah.
then you could have fracture, which that would be a very deep hole to get out of.
Exactly.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
So if you begin using an antidepressant, you and your spouse will need to understand its side effect profile. We have more to discuss with Dr. Nedlia about medications right after the break. Then we'll have a popular recipe that's a great protein for lunch. All this and much more to come after a short break. Stay tuned.
Jesus provides salvation free of charge, and here at Hope Channel, we provide quality family-friendly programs free too. That's because we want everyone to experience the hope that Jesus gives. While Salvation and Hope Channel are free, creating programs you enjoy does cost. We are viewer-supported, and if you are being blessed, let us know by your messages of encouragement and your financial gift of $10 or $20 or more. It will make a world of difference. Get hope, give today.
You can send your gift in three easy ways, www.hopetv.org/donate. Call 1-888-4-HOPE-TV. Outside of North America, call 1-269-471-6050 or mail your gift to P.O. Box 4000, Silver Spring, Maryland 20914, USA.
I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my loving eye on you.
Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm doing great.
Good. Hey, listen, another favorite recipe of mine is falafel, so I thought we'd do that today.
That's great. I love falafel.
And I got the recipe out of Teenie Finley's book, Natural Lifestyle Cooking.
Oh, so it's healthy and good.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it.
So why don't you let our viewers know what's in the recipe?
Sure. We've got 2 cups dried garbanzos, rinsed, 1 onion, 3 cloves garlic, 1 teaspoon of chopped or ground coriander leaves, 1/4 cup of finely chopped dried parsley, 1 teaspoon of ground cumin, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 cup of flour, and olive oil. And I should just say that I'm really excited, and these have such great ingredients with a bunch of flavors.
Oh, absolutely. The main ingredient, of course, being chickpeas. And what are you going to tell me about chickpeas?
Well, they've got a lot of fiber, and they do come very hard, which I know. So what you need to do is rinse or have them soak for a long time. In fact, this is one that's great for overnight.
Yeah, that's right. It's good to rinse them first and then soak them. But there, why don't you throw all of those in while I get the fry pan ready, because we're going to fry these.
And you can smell the onions.
Yeah.
I'm going to move this out of our
way.
Sorry,
can I help you with that, because it's being stubborn.
And you want all of this?
Well, maybe only half of that, yeah.
We've got our salt. Our parsley. And you know, we've got our cumin. And did you know that cumin played kind of interesting roles throughout Earth's history?
Really?
It was used by the Egyptians for embalming. And
no,
when
kidding.
Spices were very important to the Europeans, this was one of the prominent ones.
Really? Well, they use it a lot in Indian cooking too, East Indian. Here we go. I just remembered I was supposed to just grind the garbanzos and then add the rest, but here we go. Because that didn't happen when I made those. And then what we do is, I like to use the little ice cream scoop, because it makes nice, even patties, and you can just put them in there, and then, actually we should grab a fork and just squish them down.
You know, and our viewers, I'm sorry that you can't smell this, because this smells so good with the onions and the garlic, and the, it just smells so good here.
So that's how we do them. And you want to get them nice and brown on each side.
Okay, so that would take, I guess, just a few minutes?
Yeah, I like to cover it because you want to get them cooked all the way through, not just on the surface. So I keep the lid on, and probably they'll be in there 15, 20 minutes, actually. Because it's quite important to cook all the starch that's in the garbanzos.
Now, what are some of the health benefits that we get by eating these?
Because chickpeas, they have plenty of protein. They've got almost all the essential amino acids. And they've got a nice complex carbohydrate profile. Let's go over and fill our pita bread. This is one of my favorite meals just because it's so interactive, you know. I like to put in some hummus or guacamole, which we've got over there, and or some baba ganoush, and then put in the falafels and stuff them with grated carrot, lettuce, tomato, cucumber, olives. Then my last favorite is to pour in tahini sauce, which is really just tahini and water, about equal quantities, some lemon juice, garlic powder.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Yeah, and so you end up with a whole meal in one pocket.
And it's great for lunch, dinner, whatever it is.
Yeah, so we should get into this. Now let's take a look at Marcia's story and how she was affected by depression.
In 05, our youngest daughter was severely injured with a head injury. She got well. She actually did. Had a little more trouble being happy with a happy attitude, but it wasn't easy for her, so therefore it wasn't easy for any of us. Then she started getting counseling along about in 2011, and it seemed like she was getting worse, and finally after about 6 months of counseling she left home, which just devastated us, of course, because it wasn't leaving home in happy terms, it was leaving home in completely cutting us off, which is what precipitated my entrance into the 10-day recovery program. When our daughter left was the beginning of March, and there was a 10-day recovery program that started about the third week in March. My sister and I were hoping that our daughter could go to the 10-day recovery program, but and my sister happened to have vacation time already scheduled that was exactly matched the 10-day recovery program. She was totally happy to do that with our daughter, but our daughter didn't take us up on the offer. Our other daughter saw the situation. She and her husband decided that they could send me to it. And that was a whole nother story, how it worked out that they could do that. And so my other sister, who is a counselor, came with me to the program for the first part of it. And that really helped because I was just so far down that it was really nice to have somebody I knew to help support me.
That feeling of worthlessness is a classic feature of depression, and Satan is a master at reminding us of all of our failures. Now let's see what Dr. Nedley says may contribute to depression. Dr. Nedley, we've just been talking about medications for depression. They are valuable, but there are some very important side effects that I think our viewers need to know about.
Yes, an increase in impulsivity. In fact, this is the enigma of the antidepressants, the most commonly used ones, is that before they improve depression, they worsen impulsivity. And suicide is often an impulsive act. It's not an objective review of your life and you intervening, you know, to try to make your life better at all. It really is a very biased view with feelings of hopelessness on board. And then when you add impulsivity to that, that's when you get people driving across the Golden Gate Bridge and jumping. Those people, it's an impulsive act. And it turns out that's why these antidepressants have these big black box warnings on them, because they're telling the practitioner that you have to weigh this against the increased suicidality that can result, particularly among the individuals that are most impulsive in our society, and that's going to be your younger age group. And so how do you balance that risk? This is one of the reasons why we need to look for alternative treatments that are better. They're not going to worsen impulsivity.
Right, and if a family member is caring for someone who's just started antidepressant, that first 3 or 4 weeks before the antidepressant effect comes in,
that's right.
That impulsivity is there. That's their most at-risk time, and to be very careful to watch that individual.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Now, we also were talking about how you categorize the different causes of depression. You got up to number 71. What did you do after that? How did you get that down?
Yes.
What are the categories you ended up with?
Right. Well, at that point, I decided to review the 71 that I had listed out. And I found that most fall into one of 10 categories.
Okay. Give those to us.
All right. Those 10 categories are genetic, of course. Okay. There's 22 separate genes that have been identified as increasing the risk of depression. The good news is you can have all 22 of those genes and not have depression if you don't have other causes on board. So one of the things we need to understand about these categories is it takes 4 categories or more before we end up with depression or anxiety or another mental health problem.
Okay, so 4 out of 10.
Which means the brain is pretty resilient.
Yes, it does.
Because we can have one cause of depression on board and still not have it. And that's why some people think some of these causes are not important, because Uncle Joe does this, but he doesn't have depression, so obviously this isn't a direct cause. Well, Uncle Joe, that might be his only cause on board, and that's why he doesn't have it. He doesn't have the other constellation.
Or he might have 3, but
exactly.
not the 4th.
Exactly.
And he may be walking that close to the
edge. Correct.
Okay, so genetic.
Developmental.
Developmental.
This has to do with how we were raised. If we were raised in a pretty abusive environment, and we were raised with alcoholic parents or drug addict parents, et cetera, does play a toll in regards to our own mental health when we grew up. And so developmental is an important cause.
Does the abuse have to be prolonged or even just one instance?
No, it does need to be rather prolonged, and that's why we call it developmental and not just one episode. Now, if it's sexual abuse, that can just be one instance, particularly if it's, you know, severe sexual abuse, not just being, you know, patted by some little 6-year-old here or there, but, you know, particularly if it's parental or older individuals and it's severe sexual abuse, that one episode can still play a toll, and that would be a developmental hit.
Right. What comes after genetic and developmental?
Well, then is the area of nutrition is an important role. And so nutrition in the brain is crucially important, and we want to make sure that we're on the plant-based foods that are going to improve mental health and actually avoiding the foods that are going to worsen mental health.
All right. So what comes after nutrition?
Circadian rhythm.
That's a big word.
Yeah,
tell us
circadian
about
rhythm.
What is a circadian rhythm?
Circadian rhythm is our daily cycle. So that's our daily sleep-wake cycles. It's the time that we're eating. We actually do far better if we sleep at the same time every day and get up at the same time every day. And the brain does far better if that time is early to bed, early to rise. We make more and improve brain chemistry by being on a program like that.
So I'm thinking shift workers must be, who change their working habit, working times, they must be quite at risk.
They are at risk. They have a circadian rhythm hit, and clearly they have a significantly increased risk of mental health issues as well as some physical health issues that go along with that.
Okay, well, we're going to come back to this. Thank you.
All right.
So we've just covered four categories or hits that contribute to depression, and there's another six to go. When we come back from the break, we'll have the first part of a special series on exercise that combats depression. But first, let's watch today's medical news report. We are at the University of Maryland, and I'm talking today with Dr. Hinda Dubin, psychiatrist. Dr. Dubin, tell us about this particular piece of research done right here at the University of Maryland.
Well, this was a cognitive behavioral therapy study, and what they did was they used a telephone-based cognitive behavioral therapy. So actually, the patients who were being treated did not come to the hospital to be seen. Instead, they received a phone call. And what they did is they wanted to look at patients who had HIV and were also depressed, and to see if by making a phone call at a specific intervention they could get better adherence to their medication as well as treating their depression.
So it was like counseling, but over the phone.
It was, and it wasn't just hand-holding. There was a strictly manualized technique that they used, and they found at the end of the study that these patients were much less depressed and also had better compliance with their medication, which of course gives them a much better prognosis.
Right, and with HIV, medications are so important for prolonging life and reducing complications and progression, isn't it?
Right, and that's the thing. I mean, it's difficult to take medication. They did a study with medical students, and they found that trying to get them to take a medication more than once a day was almost impossible, and they knew how important it was. Here, there's a complex regimen of medications in someone who may be medically ill and, in addition, may have depression, and yet taking those medications are life-saving. So this is a really important study.
Do people with HIV have a higher rate of depression?
Unfortunately, they do. So it's just one more thing they have to struggle with is that depression. And of course, depression makes it hard to follow through on just about anything.
HIV patients are on so many medications. It's pretty challenging to think about adding an antidepressant to that mix when, in fact, cognitive behavioral therapy can be a very effective intervention.
Yes. Well, they didn't actually compare it to medication. What they compared it to was having people come in face-to-face to the clinic. And you could imagine if you are reliant on public transportation and you're reliant perhaps on someone else taking you and the time demands, et cetera, or even the fear of the stigmatization of being seen in a clinic, this allowed many more people to access the care they so desperately need.
Great study. Thank you so much for being part of it.
Well, thank you.
This year, Hope Channel celebrates 10 years on the air, and I praise God for allowing Hope Sabbath School to be a part of the Hope Channel for the past 6 years. You are also an important part of this family. Your prayers, your letters, and your financial support mean so much to us and make it possible to share these programs around the world. Thank you, and may God bless you.
Welcome back. It's time to talk about intermittent training, a special exercise program that helps the brain as well as the body. Welcome to Go Healthy's exercise segment. You know, it's important to tailor your exercise program to your level of fitness. And joining me now is Carl Parker, head coach of strength conditioning at Washington Adventist University in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Copart.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us, how could someone assess their level of fitness?
Well, I like to use the Rockport walk test. It's a one-mile test, and it gives us an idea of where you are cardiovascularly, so we know where to start you in the program.
Great. But so tell us, how might our viewers go about the Rockport walk test?
It's very simple, and that's why we like it. It's easy to do. You only need a track or a one-mile track or a treadmill set to 1 mile, a stopwatch, which most phones have a stopwatch on their phones now. So, and that's really about it.
Great. And you know, you mentioned a phone. You can actually download a free app that tells you when you've walked a mile as well. Huh?
You could. And that's another way to do it. So we any way we can, we're going to get that number down.
So measure out 1 mile, and you're going to walk for that mile. Does it matter if it's hilly or flat?
No, we prefer a flat surface so that all of our testing parameters are always the same, so we can recreate this at any time. So what you're going to do is you're going to start with a 5-minute warm-up.
Okay.
5-minute walk up, warm up at a leisurely pace. But even before that, first thing that we want to do is record your weight. Okay, mm-hmm. So we want to know what your weight is before. Then we're going to start with the 5-minute warm up. And from there, you're going to start your walk. Okay, you're going to do the walk.
How fast should they be walking?
So you should be walking at a good, I don't know if you want to just, I'll
let
you.
So just a normal walking pace.
A normal walk. It should be a brisk pace, okay? You don't want to dawdle, but you should be able to still have a conversation while you're walking.
Oh, that's a good test. So you can talk.
So if you're by yourself, you don't want to look crazy, but yes, see if you can talk.
Put your phone to your ear and start talking at it.
Right. And that way we know if we're walking fast enough, okay? Once you're done, there are two things that we have to record at the end. We want to record your heart rate immediately after.
Okay. All right.
Okay. And the completion time. How long did it take you to do a mile?
So exactly how many minutes and seconds? Now, to get your pulse, to work out your heart rate, you can do it fairly easily. You'll need to have your watch or your phone with you. Just record your pulse for 10 seconds. And then multiply that by 6 to make a minute. Or you can take it for 15 seconds and multiply it by 4, which is a little bit easier. And that way, and you can just, so 2 fingers just here on your wrist, and you can record it. Or if you find that a little tricky, then you can go to your carotid. Don't go too high under your jaw. And you can just roll off the side of the windpipe very gently. And you'll be able to feel your pulse, and again, you'll count it. Now, you'll want to use the hand that doesn't have the watch so that you can count it, 15 seconds, and multiply by 4. Now, your heart rate drops pretty quickly after you stop walking, right?
It does. It does. So that's why you want to get it as quickly as possible once you've done the workout. But in the case of any kind of workout, a cool down is very important, okay? And the cool down is we want to get that heart rate down to about 20 beats per minute within the range of what it was before you started working out. So if I started working out at about 100 beats per minute, then I want it to be, which is pretty high, but if it was 100 beats per minute, I want to be within about 120 beats before I know that I'm done with my cool down. I brought my heart down, my heart rate down safely, from a safe zone.
All right. So it's a good idea. You're suggesting it's a good idea to even check your pulse before you launch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a good idea to just know where you are, what your resting heart rate is, and so forth.
Great. So there's some homework for you. Go for a 1-mile walk on a flat trail when it's not a windy day, and remember to record exactly how long it takes. Measure your heart rate at the end. And then I have another thing I need you to do. Tomorrow morning, take your resting pulse before you get out of bed. Now, on the next show, we'll help you work out the maximum heart rate that you should be aiming at for optimal performance specifically for you. But first, let's do a couple of exercises today. What are we going to do?
Oh, yeah. Here we go. So, first thing that we're going to do, we're going to combine a couple exercises because it's always good to save time to put a few exercises together at one time. Okay, the one that we're going to combine here is a plank and a push-up and a row.
Okay?
And there are ways that we can make this easier. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the push-up and you're just going to do the row.
All right. Okay,
so way is I would go down, up, and pull. All right? Pull. And pull. All right? And you could do this for about 10 reps. Okay? Until you feel, if it's too much, then just bring it back.
Right.
Now, the whole time what you're doing is you're working on your core, okay? Because as you're trying to stay nice and flat, you're going to work on those the core muscles, your back, your legs, so that
exactly
you can
right.
get stronger because everything comes from the core, okay?
Right.
All right.
So we're working on strengthening our back and our abdomen at the same time here.
Absolutely. And when you're getting a little bit stronger and you add the push-up in, now we've also targeted the test as well. So we've gotten 3 areas out of 1 exercise.
Excellent.
Okay? Now, what I'm going to have you do, we're going to do a leg exercise now.
All right. Okay?
Legs burn the most energy in our body, so we want to activate those as much as possible.
Yeah, because they're big muscles, aren't they?
Now, you're going to grab the kettlebell,
right.
And I'm going to grab the dumbbells. Now, before I even grab the dumbbells, first thing I want to show you is that we can do a squat with just body weight.
All right.
Because, listen, I could kill you with these body weight squats and get a lot of work out of it. So the same movement that you're doing, I'm doing it without weight.
All right.
I'm making sure I'm pushing my butt back and I'm keeping my upper body as straight as possible. Okay? So as you're doing it with the kettlebell, I can do the same thing with the dumbbells. Again, my feet are about shoulder width apart, uh-huh. toes slightly out, and I'm down, and I'm up.
All right. Great. Right.
Get deep. Make sure you're getting nice and deep so you activate as much of the glutes and your hamstrings and your quads as much as possible.
Excellent. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's get that 1 mile walk in. Take your pulse, take the time, and get your resting pulse, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Studies in the 1950s showed Adventist men to have low levels of total cholesterol, an important factor in preventing heart disease. Nowadays, cholesterol can be divided into healthy and unhealthy fractions. A recent study again compared Adventist men to their non-Adventist neighbors and found their unhealthy, or LDL, cholesterol to be 9 points lower. A vegetarian diet and regular exercise were thought to make the difference. A lower LDL cholesterol is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time to answer your questions, which you've texted, called, or posted to our Facebook page. Margaret called and asked, I'm a diabetic. What is gluten and does it contribute to diabetes? Well, Margaret, gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, rye, and barley. It does not contribute or cause diabetes. However, some type 1 diabetics also have celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disorder, and those two can be related, but only because they're both autoimmune diseases. Mary called, my husband is a diabetic, which is better for him as a sweetener, stevia or agave. Well, Mary, agave has a very low glycemic index of just 15, but it does contain calories, so it will cause some elevation of blood glucose. Its sweetness comes from fructose, as does fruit. But it is sweeter than sugar, so you should use less of it than you would sugar in a recipe. It has a lovely flavour, so it's very easy to overeat on it, so go cautiously. Stevia doesn't contain calories, and it's not going to alter the blood sugar. There are also synthetic sweeteners like xylitol and erythritol, which are like stevia, and they act similarly, but they can cause diarrhoea, and so you can't have too much of them. I would recommend that you don't use artificial sweeteners like aspartame, saccharin, or sucralose. Someone else called and asked, how many vegetables should you have each day? Well, that depends on your age, your gender, and the level of physical activity that you engage in. For women, rough estimate, 2.5 cups a day, and for men, 3 cups a day. Try to make your vegetables look like a rainbow. Green leafy vegetables, red and orange vegetables, some beans and peas, some starchy veg. So don't make them all chips. They really don't count. Another caller asked, what foods increase the serotonin level, please? Well, remember that you need good sleep, good exercise, plenty of bright light. It's not just about nutrition, but try foods that are rich in tryptophan, which is then converted into serotonin. There's tofu, wheat, gluten, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, and almonds. But keep listening to this program and this series on depression because Dr. Nedley is an expert on nutrition and the brain. Thanks for sending those questions. Call us with your health question. The number's 855-400-HEALTHY. Remember, you can also text us or post your questions on Facebook. Now, before we find out what the other 6 hits are from Dr. Nedley, watch George share his story.
Well, I don't know. I never really thought of depression. Just didn't give a lot of consideration, really. I know in my childhood growing up, there just seemed to be a lot of conflict between my parents and a lot of issues that went on there. And I guess I just thought people were always supposed to stay together. And as people would move out of my life, you know, I'd have a new friend and he'd have to move and another would move and a sister would get married and things like that. I felt, I guess, dependent on other people helping me to feel fulfilled or happy. And certainly I put a lot of blame on my childhood, which I realize now isn't the case. I was very intolerant individual, just a very black and white, not willing to listen to what somebody would have to say. Although, I mean, I had friends and I was popular going through school and high school and college and had a lot of good times. And then when I married, I thought, you know, this is it, and the perfection is going to start now. And I found out, well, that's not the case either. And We had three children, and again, just a lot of the things I grew up with, a lot of the anger and bitterness and intolerance was part of my parenting and my marital skills, although skills wouldn't be the right word for that. Just a lot of pain and grief through those years. And I think at this time a couple of our children had grown and left home, and I just realized, you know, I got to the point where the worst part of the day was just waking up in the morning and realizing I'm now conscious and I have to go through another day. And I just hated that. I didn't know what to do and just really felt miserable. And of course, I was making everybody else's life miserable as well.
And that's often the worst time of the day, waking up to another day feeling hopeless and helpless. However, let's see what the other six causes for depression are. Then we can create a strategy for hope. Dr. Nedley, you've managed to synthesize all those different causes of depression into roughly 10. Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned genetic, developmental, mm-hmm. and nutrition. What would mm-hmm. be the next one?
Well, we mentioned circadian rhythm as well.
Number
five would be lifestyle. And this has to do with whether you're on a regular exercise program or not, whether you're getting enough bright light. And the bright light is best if it's sunlight or something that bright, or at least blue light, like the blue sky gives out.
Right.
And then also if you're regularly breathing fresh air. Mm-hmm. It turns out the environment that we breathe has a crucial role in regards to our mental health. And so that's a big one.
It is a big one. Yeah, so lifestyle, that's pretty global.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, we don't really think about our lifestyle in terms of depression, but it sounds like it's got so many factors, it's probably a big part of it.
It's a big part of it, yes.
Mm. What comes next?
Addictions.
Addictions. Now, I think when you say addictions, I think of maybe some street drugs.
Yes.
But you're probably thinking of...
Well, street drugs can be very addictive.
But there are not many people that use street drugs.
Not very many people.
Depression
use
is very big. So
yes, that's right.
There must be some others out there.
Well, yes, there are. And, you know, it can be even non-substance addictions. But first, the substance, sugar, you know, can be addictive. Chocolate can be addictive. These addictive things actually can cause us, the first time we use them, to kind of get a high, an mm-hmm. emotional high. But then as we continue to use it, we're no longer using it to get high, we're using it to get numb. And in between times, our brain chemistry is down in the basement, even though there's nothing sad around.
Hmm.
And so the addiction hits are important. And so, of course, alcohol, caffeine, you know, anything, any substance that is addictive can actually lead to a lack of mental health, and it's certainly suppression of the frontal lobe, et cetera.
Mm. Now, you said there were some non-substance addictions.
Yeah, non-substance addictions. One of the most common, or I should say the most rapidly rising mm-hmm. non-substance addiction is self-mutilation or cutting. People are using that in order to, quote, feel something. And if they're under stress, they'll feel a sense of release after cutting, and it's actually an addiction, and it has to be treated as an addiction, and then there is success. But there are other non-substance addictions. Entertainment television and movies are highly addictive. The rapid scene of reference sets you up for an addiction.
Wow.
And
you just want more of it.
That's right. Video games can be highly addictive. The internet, certain entertainment sections of the internet can be highly addictive. And another rapidly rising one is called a techno addict. This is a person who is in a social environment with engaging people, but he'd rather be in the corner texting someone who's not near as engaging on his texting machine rather than to engage in 3D social interactions. And techno addicts have been shown to have virtually as much problems with their brain as even low-level alcoholics people that are alcoholics but are functioning alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a very detrimental effect.
Amazing. Now, what's the next one after?
Well, the next one would be toxins.
Okay.
And sometimes we put that together with nutrition because often we get toxins in our diet.
Right.
The most toxic level of the food supply today is actually fish. because the oceans and the waters have been contaminated with mercury and pesticides and other things. Fish is actually a toxin-laden food, and the problem with that is fish have good things in them, like omega-3, and so it makes it a struggle to get your omega-3 without the toxins, which you have to be, you know, really choose the more plant-based sources, et cetera.
Right, be quite strategic about that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lead, of course, is a toxin that can have some adverse effects on the brain. Arsenic, there's other toxins out there that may need to be. Cadmium is another one. That may need to be looked for. If we don't have enough to explain the four categories of causes, then we'll start looking for those things.
And we'll get cadmium through smoking, won't we?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Arsenic can even be in our water supply.
Exactly.
Because it's in the soil. So
that's right.
Yes, and these are all heavy metals that have a predilection to going to the brain. So
correct.
They're very important.
Yes.
What about bismuth?
Bismuth is another one. Mm. Yeah. Bismuth.
And how do we get it?
Well, I mean, we can get it with a medication, you know, that's over the counter called Pepto-Bismol. It has bismuth in it, which is an antibiotic as well. It helps to fight an infection called Helicobacter, but you can get too much bismuth, and it's been shown to have some adverse mental effects.
Wow. What would be the next one?
The next one would be social hits. And so, you know, and the two that the world is caught up with is genetic and social. They recognize there's a genetic basis for depression. They recognize often there's a social basis, but most of the time they're wrong on the social part.
Is that right?
Social complications are present in everyone with depression.
Right.
But not social causes. They might be in a socially supportive environment, but because of their depression, they have complications, and then their counselor starts maybe manipulating their social life in regards to their marital life and other things, and that's not the underlying cause. Ooh. And so we need to be very careful to recognize whether the social is a cause or a complication.
Okay, we're going to come right back to that. Thank you. There's another four hits that you can work on to improve your resilience against depression. Dr. Nedley still has another two hits to explain to us coming right ahead after the break. But first, take a look at another great food item. Raspberries used to be a midsummer crop, but nowadays they're available all year round, so we really are rather spoiled. There are many different varieties and colours, but it seems that only the red raspberries are commercially available. A cup of fresh, raw raspberries contains only 65 calories, but it's loaded with phytonutrients. There are carotenoids, polyphenols, vitamins and minerals. Animal research suggests antioxidant and anti-cancer effects. Full of fiber, they are a low glycemic food. See how beautiful they are. Each berry has about 100 drupelets. They can make almost any dessert look delicious. They go well in pies and pastries, jams, jellies and toppings. But in my opinion, they're best eaten raw. Bon appetit.
Hi everybody, it's Fernita Buddy, and I want to know, are you enjoying Hope Channel as much as I am? If God is blessing you through our broadcast, let us know. Call or write today. Please remember, Hope Channel is a free service. We're here 24/7 because of your support. With the finest Bible study and practical living programs, stand with us as we give you the best in Christian television. Be a part of our family of hope. $10 or $20 to change your life. Get hope, give today. You can send your gift in three easy ways, www.hopetv.org/donate. Call 1-888-4-HOPE-TV. Outside of North America, call 1-269-471-6050 or mail your gift to P.O. Box 4000, Silver Spring, Maryland 20914, USA.
I love learning about my ancestors. It makes me feel like I have a place in history. And I always tell my family, the more you learn about your past, the more you understand the present. But the past doesn't have all the answers, especially about the future. There's so much uncertainty and so much fear in the world today, which is why I'm so happy that I found something that brings together my past, my present, and my future. I know that no matter what happens, there is a plan. And this gives me hope.
Welcome back. Remember to call us with your health question at 855-400-HEALTHY. And today we're talking about depression, and we're going to hear from Dr. Nedley what the last two hits are that contribute to depression. But first, meet Mackenzie as she tells her story. It's unbelievable.
It started way back when I was actually 13. I was sexually abused, so that caused a lot of anxiety and fear in me, and throughout, you know, high school, I was, you know, still anxious, was having some issues still, very depressed, didn't want to do anything. I quit softball, which was the love of my life at the time, and I ended up having a child, but even the love of my own child did not take away my pain and my depression. It had gotten to the point where I didn't want to live anymore, and I had to take a leave of absence from work for 3 months because I couldn't get out of bed in order to go to work. I had a boyfriend at the time who we decided to go to Mexico, and we ended up fighting while I was there. We broke up, and after that, even, you know, my child at home, the life ahead of me, none of it mattered. I was so depressed that I wanted to take my life. And I overdosed while I was there. I was in the hospital in Mexico, and they'd called my parents, told my parents that they didn't know if I was gonna make it. I was in a coma, and the guy that I was with had left me in Mexico. The Mexican hospital did not want to let me out because my bill was not completely paid. So my dad begged on the phone, please let her out, please let her out.
That was an amazing video. Now, Mackenzie became one of your patients, didn't she?
Yes, absolutely. She came to us after having two suicide attempts in 3 days.
Really?
In a vacation land.
So where did she get the medications? In a vacation spot?
Well, I mean, she was on medicines when she down there for her depression, but she was also a pharmacy tech, so she knew these medicines well. Hmm. And she tried to overdose on one that's an anti-anxiety drug called Klonopin first, and she had to stay overnight in the hospital, but finally it was out of her system to go back to her vacation land hotel with her boyfriend. And then after that, she took a drug called clonidine that she was taking for some of the effects on the mental aspects of her health, but it's actually a blood pressure medicine, mm-hmm. and she knew that was a blood pressure medicine, so she knew if she took enough that she was going to die, and she really wanted to die, and she almost did.
Wow.
I mean, it lowered her blood pressure so significantly that she almost died and was in the hospital for days, and her boyfriend takes off, leaves her down there.
Just
in
amazing.
The hospital.
Wow.
And talk about social hits. This was a girl who had always been kind of addicted to the social aspect of things. She always had to have a boyfriend. And, you know, being an attractive girl and having some, you know, positive features, she was a magnet for boys. Yeah. And so she just kind of went from one boyfriend to another.
Wow. How many medications was she on?
She was on five.
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 And she was just a teenager.
Five, just a teenager.
Now, we were talking about the social hits. Tell us a little bit more. Does that encompass things like grief and loss and, you know, family dynamics, all those and that you've listed under social?
Well, yes, if you do undergo a sudden significant loss, that can be a social hit. In Mackenzie's case, one of the losses that she was experiencing is she was down there with her boyfriend and looking at his iPhone and recognizing she wasn't the only one. And so you added on a big, you know, for someone who's kind of addicted to the social aspect of things and with boyfriends and then recognizing that and then having some of the other hits on board, it was enough to do that. Or feelings of isolation. And you can be surrounded by people but still be isolated, per se.
Yeah.
And so what we look for actual causes are social isolations or those that seem to have relationship addictions with the people that do not help them. And so that would be an indication of an actual social cause.
Wow, that's really key for young people, isn't it?
Yes,
So what other hits are there? We've only got two left, haven't we?
Yes, well, we have the medical hits, and so things like thyroid problems or an autoimmune disease or, you know, strokes in the frontal lobe, even head trauma counts as a medical hit. Head trauma sets the head up for some physiologic changes that can threaten the health.
Well, I think I'm thinking now of athletes and football players.
Yes, NFL football players are much higher risk for depression.
Wow.
Boxers, et cetera, anything that subjects you to head trauma is going to significantly increase your risk.
And then the elderly with the medical conditions,
because
we do collect those as well.
Exactly, strokes, et cetera, that can do it.
And then finally?
Finally, the frontal lobe. This is a large category.
Right.
Because there's a lot of things that can adversely affect the frontal lobe of the brain.
Why is the frontal lobe? I mean, our brain is divided into so many parts. And what function does the frontal lobe perform?
Well, the frontal lobe is the seat of spirituality, morality, and the will. And it's actually the analytical portion of our brain. And it was amazing when scientists first began to discover that depression actually more adversely affects the frontal lobe, or the frontal lobe is actually what brings about the depression, the lack of frontal lobe performance, more so than the emotional areas of the brain. We used to think depression was just an emotional disease.
Right.
But what brings about the emotional disease is a suppression in the frontal lobe of the brain. So under scans, we'll see a decrease in circulation of at least 40%, sometimes activity is down 80% in the frontal lobe of the brain.
My.
And that's what brings it about.
Wow. That's phenomenal. So what comes first, the drop in circulation or the depression?
Well, the drop in circulation comes first. Yeah, Drevets presents compelling evidence that it's the frontal lobe adverse effects that bring about the depression and not the other way around.
Fascinating. We're going to get into this deeper. But thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're very welcome.
Well, there we have it. 10 hits that contribute to depression. Genetic, developmental, nutritional, circadian, lifestyle, addictions, toxins, social complications, medical illnesses, and the frontal lobe. Remember that you need at least 4 to suffer from depression. So don't blame your genes or your upbringing entirely. They may be just half the problem. The other half is fixable. Join us tomorrow for some practical ways to find those fixes and learn more about intermittent training. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you tomorrow.